Welcome to the Drive Phase Podcast, the best podcast for information on issues surrounding sports business in the Caribbean. On the Drive Phase, we have discussions with sport administrators, coaches, athletes, and various stakeholders in the sporting industry and examine their contribution to sports and entrepreneurship. Here's your host, Dalton Myers.
Thanks, Colleen. In this episode, we look at the business of sports, my journey. And I have with me Mrs. Juliet Cuthbert Flynn. Juliet is 5-time Olympian, a government member of parliament, and entrepreneur. She has won 3 Olympic medals, 4 world championship outdoor medals, and 1 indoor. Mrs. Cuthbert Flynn has years of experience in sport administration and currently plays a crucial role in the Olympian Association. Juliet, welcome.
Thank you for having me. All right, it's a pleasure being here.
Awesome, man. It's a pleasure having you. Let's talk about your early years in sport. What caused you to go into track and field?
Well, what caused me to go into track and field is Jamaica is track country. And from the primary school level, we're track country because everybody must participate in sports day. And that's how it started for me in Port Morant, a little town, Port Morant, St. Thomas. And of course, like every boy and girl, I was running around. Everybody wants to race. You have this thing, let's race. Yeah. And of course, I was beating everyone. Once I got to primary school, of course, the race continued and they had sports day and decided, I'm going to go out and try out. Since I beat everybody on the road, I must can win a race. Entered reluctantly, of course, you know, entered sports day from my house. And I end up winning everything. I won every race. Then we had down where we lived, this place called Cotton Tree. That was like the track. That is the center of where everything happens. And so we had our sports day at Cotton Tree in Port Morant. And I remember winning every race. And it took off from there, you know. Yeah. Got a scholarship to Morant Bay High. There was a man, Howard Jackson, who I guess I caught his eye. He would follow me around at these track meets. I'd transferred from Port Morant All Age to Morant Bay All Age. Okay. And he started following me around at, you know, these little track meets. And I kept seeing this man in these glasses following me and watching me. And I'm like, who's this weird person? And anyway, he came up to me and introduced himself, told me who he was. And then after, I ended up at Morant Bay High and it all soared from there.
But there weren't a lot of track meets back then as we have now, right? So how did you stay on top of your game in terms of just keep competing to make it to the national team?
We had some police youth club races. And I remember coming into Kingston, don't know where I was, this little country girl, and going to some track meets, taking part in some track meets. But the high school, you know, high school kept you busy. So we had Eastern Champs. You had some other little races here and there, track meets. And then, of course, the big one, it was Girls Champs, by the way. Not Boys and Girls Champs. It was Girls Champs. The lonely Girls Champs. Yes. Where you had 5 people in the stadium. But it was exciting for us coming in from, I remember when we used to drive on Mountain View Avenue and you see the lights, you know, so you reach stadium, you're close. So that was a lot of fun for us getting out of the country and getting on the bus and coming to Champs and competing. It was. I think that's how we stayed on top of the game with continuous training that we did in the hills of Morant Bay and just a few track meets that we had.
And then the transition to University of Texas.
Yes.
And that was on a scholarship.
Right. But it happened where I actually migrated. Mm-hmm. I went to the United States, not on a scholarship, but I went. My mother was in Philadelphia and went to school at Olney High in Philadelphia. And then I had actually gone to the Olympic Games in 1980 as a schoolgirl at Morant Bay High School. And you know, I'm very, you know, I love to meet people and I love men company. And I met a lot of youth then, I guess, from the track team. Zelle, who was Desmond Morris, he was on the track team from KC, you know, Pottinger, Marlon Pottinger, all those guys. And they were on a scholarship at University of Texas. Mm-hmm. We kept in touch. So when I went to Olney High in Philadelphia, we stayed in touch. And then all these schools were recruiting me from up north. And I'm like, there is no way I'm going going to run at your school. It's too cold up here. I'm not staying up north. And then when they told me, the first thing I asked was, does it snow? Does it snow down there in Austin, Texas? And they said, every now and then, but it's not a place where it's snowy, snowy. I was sold. And I said, talk to the coach. They told the coach what time I ran and that I went to the Olympics. The coach, that's how they recruited me, by the way. They never saw me compete, you know. Really? I guess they looked up the stats to know that, yes, she did go to the Olympics and this is her time. They recruited me over the phone.
And it's not like, no, and a lot of our listeners would be trying to understand this. We didn't have a lot of video technology for you to send to the coach for him to recruit you.
Not at all. It was my word. They pretty much took my word. And then they had a little conversation, I think, with the coach there in Philly to find out what time I was running. Mm-hmm. I was so bored there. I had no competition at all, Nihai. Mm. I was the fastest thing that I've ever seen as a schoolgirl. And so I was just this thing, you know, but they spoke with the coach and got some of the times I was running, and then they recruited me from just Desmond Morris and the other guys telling them that, yeah, she went to the Olympics and this is her time.
You talk about the Olympics, and I wanted to take us back there. That first experience as a schoolgirl competing at an Olympics.
I actually didn't compete.
Well, not compete, but on the team.
On the team. It was fun. I didn't want to go, you know. Can you imagine?
Why not?
I was just like, Russia? What? No. I heard things about Russia. Yeah, I didn't want to go back. This was not Russia. This is the Soviet Union. And so I didn't want to go. And my coach insisted that you must go to the trials. And if you make the team, you're going. So I went, but it was fun. I met Kathy Rattray on the team. We were both 16. She was a little bit older. And we became friends on the team. So I had some, you know, I formed some good friendship. It was fun. It was a lot of fun. Vilma Charlton, who is still with us.
Yes.
Vilma Charlton made sure that I went to all the different events and to get the experience. I didn't want to go to the opening ceremony. She was like, no, you have to go to the opening ceremony. And you know what? It was one of the best opening and closing ceremony that I've ever witnessed.
That's one.
In an Olympic Games, yes. Mm. I remember everything from Mishka the Bear. If you ask me what the other mascots are in any of the other Olympics, I don't remember their names. But Mishka the Bear stood out for me. That was my first Olympics. Mishka the Bear was, and then they made Mishka, everybody had a placard up and they made Mishka the sign and they let go the doves. It was beautiful. It was awesome and a great experience for me. Once I got to that Olympics, I was like, wait a minute, there is something bigger than girls' champs. There's something bigger than Karifta, because I'd made a couple of Karifta teams. Yeah. And I was like, wait a minute, there's a whole world of sports out here. And that was when I said, I must go to the next Olympics and compete. And I made up my mind then that I wanted to continue and go to the next Olympic Games, because it was such, when I saw all the different people from the different countries, those days we used to exchange pins from the different countries and
they still do. They still
probably not so much. But it was so much fun seeing the different athletes from the different countries and, you know, the camaraderie. It was a lot of fun.
Talk about experience. So you'd have moved from that to many other Olympic Games, or a few more. Which for you is the most memorable Olympic game? And why?
Well, okay, so they're memorably in two different sense.
All right,
so
fair enough,
memorably
explain.
Was the wonderful, great experience to open my eyes to a new world was, of course, 1980, because I remember details of those Olympics because I wasn't competing. I was there as a spectator watching and hearing about the bronze medals that we got from Merlin and our cyclist Weller. And so, but when it comes as far as competition, I have to say Barcelona.
Yeah.
You know, standing on that podium, nothing, you can't be prepared for that moment. It's like they're calling your name and you're going on top of that podium and putting your neck like this. So they put the medal over your neck. That was exciting. And not just once, twice. Mm-hmm. I was able to do that when I was an underdog. Nobody expected me to have come away with a medal or medals for that.
Yeah.
It was a wonderful experience. Something I'll never forget. I mean, just going through the motion of the different races, the heats and the semifinal, and still being the underdog, even though throughout the rounds I went under 11 seconds and I was still like, nobody was calling my name. They said I was going to get fifth, and I was like, I'll see about that fifth place. I'm not getting fifth. I am getting a medal. And so it was exciting for me because I was having fun at the same time while I was focused on winning.
All right. Throughout that time, you would have formed a relationship with Merle and Artie.
Mm-hmm.
Explain for our listeners what that relationship did for your career in terms of just making all of those transitions.
Well, Merlene, I first met Merlene back in 1980. I was actually her roommate, so I had to be on my best behavior because Merlene was such a nice girl and quiet, and I was this loudmouth, right? Didn't keep still. Merlene was more reserved, and so I was, of course, trying to take her out of her shell. But she was so focused on what the task at hand, and I wasn't going to run, so there was no focus there. So we hit it off then in 1980, and then when I moved to California after school, we met again. We were in the same training camp, so we became friends and we formed this bond. So while living in California, after I had my son, I was going through some really, really trying times. Had no money, I had nowhere to live, you know, almost moving to a Salvation Army because I was just like, I want to continue my career. Mm-hmm. And I had no money and I had nobody to really help me. And I remember it was an athlete, Johnny Gray, who actually put me up in a hotel for a couple of days. He said, I'll put you up for a couple of days, because I was determined I did not want to go back to Philadelphia because it was too cold and I wouldn't have continued my training. And, you know, I got some support from some of the athletes there. And after going through those trying periods, I ended up finding a job. So I ended up working full time and training. I then found an apartment. Then I called up Jamaica and I asked them for some funds. And they actually sent me some money. I said, I need my first month's deposit. Mm. And so I got the down payment, put that down and got an apartment. After getting the apartment, of course, you know, trials and tribulation. And of course, I was pregnant before I knew it. It was the Olympics and I decided I wanted to have a child and take a little break. And, you know, at the time, I still really didn't have any money. I don't know why I planned that. But after, you know, Merlene saw the struggles I was going through, and I mixed my workout from college to my college workout with the workout that this coach was giving me. And I had separated from that camp in California from that coach because he was a known drug coach. Mm. And he kept talking to me about taking steroids. And I'm just like, look, man, I'm an NCAA champion. I was the best person in this United States of America. I don't need anything. I can do this on my own. And if anybody knows me, I'm very stubborn. And once I put my mind to something, that's it. Don't talk to me about changing my mind. And that year after having my son, I struggled a little bit, but I ran 22.7. The following year, I ran 11.03, 11.01, 11.02. It was just 11.0 every time. I could tell what time I was going to run. And Merlene watched me, and then I made it. We got a gold medal in Tokyo in the relay. And she watched me that year, I believe. And she came over to me at the end of the season. She said, you know, you are so good. You're so talented. She says, if anybody could beat me, it's you. You are so talented. After everything that you went through, I cannot believe you are able to actually come out and run this well by training yourself. Because at this time, I was coaching myself throughout it. So I was working full time, coaching myself, taking care of my son. And I still ran 11.0. And she was like, wow. She said, I'm going to give you my workout because I know that you can run 10.7. And I was like, really? Anyway, I made a transition, left the relationship that I was in, very abusive, and move on back to Texas. Bought a fax machine. You know about a fax machine?
I do know about fax machine. probably not my producer, Rashik. I do know about it.
Bought my fax machine.
Or Andre.
And Sandy Richards was still in Texas. Call up Sandy. I said, Sandy, hey, remember those apartments, so and so and so? Here's a deposit. Put it down for me. I'm moving back to Texas. That's what happened. Bought my fax machine. And Merlene at the time was living in Italy. So she started faxing my workout to me. And then I would have to fax her back the times, like what I did that week, to tell her how my performance was, because everything was time-based. If you have 3 times 250, this is the time you have to run them in, between 32 to 36 or whatever. And so that is how she actually helped me out and gave me the workout. And I went to, I in 1992, came to Jamaica and actually beat her in the trials.
First, yeah.
And then went to Barcelona and ended up beating her in the 100 and 200 meters.
Was she ever upset with you for that? No, or she just expected it and thought you were doing really well?
Yeah, I don't think she was upset with me. I don't think if we had that bond, that it was more of a sisterly kind of bond, that she wanted to see me perform well. And if, as she would say, if anybody's going to beat me, I'd rather it be me. You know, she would rather me, a Jamaican, beating her than anybody else. So I don't think she was upset. I was more upset that she didn't beat me. You know, I was upset that she didn't get that medal in the 100 meters. I was really upset about that. Like, you know, what happened? And then in the 200 also, you know, she ended up getting the bronze in that. But it was upsetting to me that she didn't get a medal in the 100 meters. I didn't. I expected her to be ahead of me in the 100 meters. That didn't happen.
Okay, and we know what track and field is. Probably you just were ahead of her in terms of just, you know, performance-wise, you know, in times, etc. Probably you just never realized it, but she saw that you were doing really well.
Actually, yeah, because she had a coach that was overseeing her. And I remember we went to, I would kind of latch on. You know, I wasn't making the kind of money they were. So I would latch on and go to the same training camp and just kind of, you know, hang out and do my workout, because that was the same workout we were doing. And I remember one of our coach came over to me and said, you know something, because mentally how I am, he said, you are the only person that I think out there that can actually beat Merlene. And this was during a training session. He showed me the watch, one of my training session, which I thought the time was slow. And he came and he said, oh, Juliet, you ran. And he told me like a really bad time. And I was like, wow. And then he came and he showed me the watch. And I was like, wow, did I just run that time in the 150? And I was like, I'm ready. And he looked at me and he said, you are ready. This is right before going into Barcelona, into the village. He said, you are ready. And so when he said that to me, I was just like, I am ready. This is like the coach that everybody looks up to. Hank Krynoff back in the Netherlands. And he said, you're ready. And from he said that to me, I knew that I was. And Merlene could see it. Merlene actually was still coaching me, because I didn't have a coach. While we were at the game, she would say, okay, you look good. You're ready. Your first 30 meter, or fix this or fix that. She was giving me pointers. So, you know, we hung out together, warmed up together. I would watch her back. She would go and do her warming up, and then I would come back, and then, you know, she would go and do her thing. But it was fun. Lots of fun.
Okay, so you then started to make money, I'm sure, after a while. What's the difference, though, Juliet, between yourself and many of the other athletes, certainly your contemporaries, who have not made that transition, had not saved, or fallen on hard times, while you have managed to be a successful entrepreneur and an Olympian?
And, you know, let me tell you, I think I got some training also from Merlene, because Merlene is very frugal. It's a very frugal woman. She saved. She believed in saving. She didn't believe in the flashiness. I remember in Merlene one that they were used to give out those cars for the Grand Prix. And I think she gave that car away because she didn't really drive. But I think I learned from her. She told me how to invest money. She told me about the stock market, mutual funds, you know, make sure you have your kind of like your 401k, your investment, your life insurance, all of that. So I got out life insurance very early. Believed in that. I started investing in mutual funds. And so even at times when I fell on my face, I had a little savings here and there. And so that carried me through. So I always budgeted. So if I came back, I knew I had X amount of months before competition. I would say, okay, I have, after paying my mortgage, I bought a house that was within my means. So I didn't buy an expensive house. I bought something that if I couldn't run tomorrow, I've thought about it. If I got a regular job, will I be able to pay my mortgage? And when the answer was yes, that's a house that I bought. So I didn't follow everybody that was buying, you know, luxurious homes that couldn't afford it, because I knew of athletes who actually bought houses and lost the house because their career then started going downhill. So it was really about being wise with my money and investing and saving as much as I could and not trying to live up to other expectations and to follow the Jones, to live, you know, to do what other athletes were doing.
And then how did you decide that it was time to hang up the spikes?
Let me tell you, you always know when it's time. And I don't know why some people just hang in there, you know, and just, when I got Achilles tendonitis and plantar fasciitis, it happened for, that just kept going on for like an entire year and you lose money. Yeah. You can't compete, but you have bills to pay. You have your mortgage. I didn't have a car payment because I bought everything that I own cash. So all my furniture was cash. So if I didn't have the money, it wasn't going to be bought. And that's, I still live that way now. If I don't have the money, I don't have any credit cards, you know.
I should follow you.
Yeah, well, I'm going to get one now because I'm traveling quite a bit and I have to call the bank to tell them, you know, I'm going away and I don't like that. So, but I live within my means even now. And I think it's probably the fear of being broke. You know, I just don't want to be ever flat broke on my face. So I always invest. Even when I see you here, Mr. Mabrook, I have a little bit of money put away somewhere. But it's something I think these athletes should learn to do. Everybody's trying to, you know, live somebody else's life. And you should just live your own life.
Just going back to that, once the injury came about for a long period, you recognized it was probably time for you to...
Yes, that was it. I just did not want to be flat broke on my face. Yeah. And the injury was costing me money. And I kept spending money to get the injury better. It wasn't getting any better. And I had to look at my bank account and say, you know, this is dwindling. And I want to be able to have something when I'm done. I want to be able to keep my house when I'm finished. Yeah. And I assessed everything. And then the Olympics was coming up 2000. And I said, why am I going to the Olympics just to go make a team? I think that was it too. I was like, okay, I made the 1999 World Championship team and decided then I was going to retire right at the stadium. I said to Merlin, if I got fourth, I'm not going. And I got fourth. So I would have been an alternate for the relay. I would have been on the relay team. Right, because I got fourth. And I go, why am I going just to run on a relay team? Give the opportunity to someone else who's younger, who to give them the opportunity. I already had enough opportunities. And that's why I gave it up.
That's interesting. All right. So talking about being frugal, spending, etc., I guess that's what led you into entrepreneurship. Starting up your own business. And doing well at it.
Yes, starting on my own business was always something. I'm very headstrong. I knew that I didn't want to work for anybody. I wanted to be my own boss. I did not want to be stuck in a cubicle with no windows or I would go mad. I just knew what I wanted and I prepared myself. I took some personal training courses and I really love sports and I love training. I love the body and how the body works. And so that was always interesting to me. Just with illnesses, I wanted to be a nurse, you know, so I'm very fascinated with the blood and gore that some people would go, you know. Okay. I'm very fascinated. I read books on how we die. So I love how the body works and I wanted to kind of delve more into that. And so I decided I want to actually open my own gym. So when I came to Jamaica on a total different note. I came to Jamaica working for Puma. Puma actually gave me an opportunity through Juliet. I was going to say Juliet Cuthbert. Through Juliet Campbell. To Juliet Campbell. And came to Jamaica working for Puma here. And then after that, I said, you know, I'm not going back. I'm going to stay. I like it here. I think I can live in Jamaica with all the chaos. And decided to stay. And then I was a physical trainer for Arnett Gardens football team. I love that, by the way. I think I want to do more of that kind of a training, the physical thing. And then I decided to open my gym and I did it after saying I want to open my gym, it was open within like a month.
And part of that also, so you have opened your gym, which I probably should visit. You work with teams. You also did some work with the Contender, the Rare Navy Contender series. You did commentary. And didn't you dabble with coaching athletes also?
No, I didn't do any coach. No. Well, I think I did with one young lady and I was just like, this is not for me. I was like, this is not for me. Okay. I think I'll just stick with the personal training. But we closed the gym actually about a year ago, but I want to go back. I'm trying to regroup now to kind of get back into it and focus mainly on just personalized one-on-one training. I still run a boot camp, by the way, and I have a boot camp every Saturday. But I definitely am looking for another space now to do something. But I love that.
I have two persons here who I would suggest. I'm going to recommend that
for
you
personal
take them
training
on for personal training boot camp. And everything. One is Andre Sawyers and the other is Rashika Grant.
They're shaking their heads, going, no, not me.
I am going to recommend. They need your help. All right. I'm making that recommendation right now. All right. So let's start now about politics. What caused you to move into representational politics? I won't ask you what caused you to choose one party over the other. I don't want to get either of us in trouble. What caused you to move into politics?
You know, I'm very passionate about my country. I'm very passionate about people. And I know the struggles that I've been through as a young girl and just growing up and finding my way. But I was very inquisitive and I wasn't shy. I wasn't afraid to ask the questions to get to where I'm going. And you find that a lot of people are not like me and they won't ask the questions and they'll just kind of sit back and, you know, things happen. And I recognize that a lot of people, when I was campaigning or when I went into the political arena, I realized that a lot of people just didn't know how to access certain things. And after just talking to people, because I'd volunteer as a little, like a big sister, kind of a thing. And I decided this is something I want to do. I want to be able to have a voice for the people. I want to be able to go out there and speak on behalf of the people who don't have a voice or who feel that they don't have a voice. I want to be that representative of theirs. And that is really the reason why. And I saw just too many things happening that I thought, you know, I could really make a difference, you know. I'm very grateful for the opportunity for the people of Westerwald who voted for me. And I don't think they have any regrets. Maybe some of them, but I think for the majority. Because you're always going to find those people who don't like you for whatever reason.
Will you go back for a next term?
I'm going back for a next term.
All right, awesome. So you're ready for the...
I am ready for the bell to ring.
Okay. All right. Well, you're a sports person, so I'm sure you're always ready for a competition from any other one.
Eh? Yes, and there is a competitor now on the PMP side.
Correct.
And I'm ready. I'm always... You know, athletes, we're always ready.
Let me ask if you're ready for something else though, because you want to get back into a lot of your job, your gym, etc. What if the Prime Minister should then give you a cabinet role or ask you to take on bigger roles within the party? How would that work? And would you be prepared for that?
I've never thought of that. I'm a backbencher and I kind of love being a backbencher.
But backbenchers tend to move to middle or front bench at some point, you know.
Well, I don't know what the Prime Minister have in mind, but I think I'll be able to balance. I balance very, very well. And I think even a ministerial role, in a state ministry role or whatever, I think I would still find time because the gym starts at 4.
Yeah,
you know, gym starts at 4,
that's
5
why I
o'clock.
Be making it.
And so I would still be able to do that early in the morning, train my clients and still have time to actually go and represent the people or represent in whatever ministerial role there is. But I would actually love to move on. Even though I love being a backbencher, I would love because I think I have so much to give, so much to offer, especially in sports. I think I have a lot to give in sports. And so I would love to not just waste my talent. And if I feel like it's going to be wasted, then I'll go full force into the gym thing, back into the gym world.
Yeah, and take these two that we have with you. All right. What are some of the challenges you see facing athletes or preventing athletes from being successful?
I think facing them now, not sure if there are too many challenges. There's so much more that they have now than what we had before. The money is quick and fast and easy to come by.
And easy to go.
And I think a lot of these athletes need to be more focused. You know, I think they need to be a little bit more focused and not so focused on the money and find a good camp. Not everybody is a fit for Jamaica to stay here. Not everybody, I know we have great coaches here, but not everybody is a good fit to stay here. And I think that is some of the things that's possibly happening to us. We find that some are staying and then they realize, it's not for me. And then you see them going overseas and it's kind of too late in their career because it's a short career. You know, from the time you hit 25, you start to kind of, you know, if you weren't up here. And so I think that is one of the challenges I think these athletes are faced. It's probably too many choices that they have and they don't know. The guidance is not there for them to figure out what is best for me. And there are too many people going to them saying, this is what's best for you, and them not being able to think for themselves to say, this might not be what is good for me. There are many athletes who left and went overseas and did well. And I think the athletes need to actually possibly look at the possibilities for them and to figure out what's going to work best for me.
Yeah. What are some other advice would you give to young athletes who are listening, who are watching, and they want to become the next Juliet Cuthbert?
I don't know if they want to become, to be the next Shelley and Fraser.
No,
Price.
Well, you still do have some very good times put down out there that a lot of athletes haven't hit to this date.
Yeah, I think it's really about maintaining, you know, for the young ones, the family need, if they have family members, to really steer them in the right direction, because a lot of people will come at you, and most of those people are coming at you, they're coming at you for the money that they can make from you. And so some of them are not necessarily focused on your career, mainly it's just really them and that fast money. So be very careful, choose wisely. Do you want to continue in education and your career? Because you can do both now.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the shoe companies allow you to do both. Or do I just want to run and then you get injured, you have nothing to fall back on? Think about those things. Education is very important. You know, you might not do anything with it, because you might make so much money, like some people, that you didn't really need to go to school, but not everybody falls into that category. So, I mean, I would say get that guidance and that balance and figure out exactly what it is that you want as an athlete, and then see the fit that, you know, is there. Feel out. Everybody's going to come to you trying to manage you and say, I'm going to be so and so. Find out more about what they're about. And what can they do for you? How are they going to push your career forward? And how are they going to move you to the next level? And I think those are some of the questions that our athletes need to ask these managers.
If there is one thing that you could tell an athlete that you thought you did wrong, that you probably would give a better advice now looking back, what would that one thing be?
Well, I wish I'd had a coach. I wish I had a coach. I see some athletes now making some decisions, leaving one coach to the next and coming back and not knowing what to do. You know, maybe it's not the coach. Maybe you have to soul search and figure out, is it something with me? Is it my time to go? Or what is it with me? So I would tell the athletes to really, you know, don't move from camp to camp or coach to coach. Figure out exactly what is going on. Is it something that I can fix instead of moving around? For me, it was mainly I should have gotten a coach. But I think I was so scared because I didn't want anybody to tell me to take drugs that I kind of stuck with myself. That's my regret from the whole track and field scenario. So I would tell the athletes to know who they are, know what you want, and do those things. Follow that guide.
All right. I have another tough question for you. Well, I think it is a tough question, right? So a lot of persons aren't comfortable with the, you know, I wouldn't say competencies, but certainly with our National Track and Field Association here in Jamaica. They think there's a lot more could be done. What role do you see yourself playing in developing track and field in Jamaica?
You know, yes, I think we need to revamp what's been happening with the J3A in Jamaica. I think it's time that we kind of take a look, step back and take a look at what's been happening. How has it been run? All of those things. Look at what have we been doing wrong?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things that we could do better. And I think sometimes I feel like we're not placing the athletes first. We're looking at other things. And I think the athletes should be priority because it's the athletes who actually make you. But because I think we have so many athletes that come that people just feel as if, well, if you go, then we're always going to have athletes. Yeah. And so I think the J3 can play a much better role in when they're making decisions to think about the athletes. When you look at the trials and look at different things, and when we had our trials, I think those are some of the things. Look at the athletes' welfare. And I think that is something that needs to be looked at and revamped. I'm not sure what they have in place now.
I'm not sure yourself.
But the whole welfare of the athletes. Be more inclusive with your athletes, your past athletes. You're not using them. Mm-hmm. I look at the USA and I just marvel. I'm like, wow. I look at Sharifa Barksdale, who ran with me back in the 1980s. Sharifa Barksdale is playing an important role in the USA track and field right now. Robin Johnson, who went to school with me at the University of Texas, who wasn't any great athlete, but she's a part of the coaching staff of the USA staff. They've selected her actually to go to the Olympics already next year. They're very inclusive. They're including their athletes. Look at what, you know, don't just look at some people. Look and see what are some of the positives that we can take from some of our athletes who have gone, you know, mm-hmm, or mm-hmm, Olympians, and see how we can integrate them and put them into this role, into the J3 or JOA, and see what kind of role they can play to actually move the sport forward. I think we need a big revamping. There's so much more that we can do. So much more that we could do. I would love to see, you know, maybe it's just not just the J3A, but what I want to see happen is for us to fix up the stadium where we're able to actually treat our athletes there, have the physiotherapy, the cold tub, the whole physiotherapy room for athletes to be able to access that. And I think those are some of the things that we need to see happen. And it's just not happening.
Yeah. Another thing that just came to me while you're talking about that, and it's nutty, and I'm sure Rashika is going to cuss me for continuing on these, but it, just this week we celebrated the Child's Day, mm-hmm, and we had some kids who came to Parliament to talk, and the UNICEF, you know, has been pushing us to do more for children.
Yeah.
What role do you see sports in either one helping our children? And how has it been at a disadvantage for a lot of kids? How has it been used as a space to abuse children? And how can we correct some of those? Probably three questions in one.
You know, sports help a lot. Sports helped me as a child. I don't think I would have been a bad child, so to speak. But it actually helped to steer me in the right direction. I think we can develop sports in a better way in Jamaica on a whole, especially in the inner city communities where they don't have certain things. You look at just play areas or, you know, different things. A lot of the schools, places now, they're having these artificial turf. How many of those kids can actually really afford to go to some of those places? I think sports can play a very integral role in you know, protecting our kids, our children. I don't think we really use it to maybe say abuse our children in Jamaica, because I think, you know, we have set some standard that even say boys and girls champs, where you're not overworking the kids. I don't think the kids are overworked at the primary level either. And so I don't see it in that set, but I think sports can actually change a lot of lives. And you look at, I saw Usain post something. He was doing a seminar there, and he goes, look at the little boy from Trelawney.
Yeah.
That's what sports did for him. Who would have known? And so I think we need to push sports more in communities. In sport need to do more.
Huh.
In sport need to do more, and really, what is their mission statement? What is their vision? And they need to do more of what they're supposed to be doing.
Yeah.
And I think in sport is just kind of there, and you just hear about in sport when it comes to primary champs.
Primary champs, really.
But I don't see them going into the communities and really developing and doing the things that they should.
Yeah.
And that is what's lacking. And that is what I would love to see happen. Again, as I said, I see so much more could be done. And It should start from in sport. You're supposed to develop sports, yeah, and you're not developing the sports at all. And it's not just track and field. Track and field is not only sport.
It's one of many.
One of many. And they're not doing what they're supposed to do.
Listen, I could follow up on that, but I wanted to ask you one last question. What's next for Gillette?
Winning at the next election.
Well,
going back into parliament to do the people's work.
Right.
And I have a new project coming. I'm opening a new center. It's a homework center for the people in the Stony Hill area, but mainly for the children. What we'll do is have a homework center in the evening and maybe put a hard skills training in the mornings, BPO and probably web page design in the mornings. That should be finished by February. So listen out for that or look out for that on my social media page. That I know you follow me.
Yeah.
I follow you.
Yeah, she's on every social media
so
page.
So, yeah, that is what's coming next. But I plan to continue working for the people, really, of West Royal St. Andrew and continue in politics for at least one more term and then go on to other things.
All right. Well, listen, Gillette, thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And as usual, on behalf of producer Rashika Grant, engineer Andre Sawyers, program advisor Marsha Boyce, thanks for joining us for another episode of The Drive Phase. Remember to check out our website. It is available. So visit, and it's at thedrivephase.com. Make sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or any other podcast that you may use, so you'll never miss an episode. Remember, we'd appreciate any ratings on whichever podcast that you use. Go tell a friend about the show so they too can spread the word. Feel free to send feedback, comments, or questions to thedrivephase@gmail.com or look us up on Twitter and Facebook at The Drive Phase. Remember to use the hashtag TDP. Until then, see you.